Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on Cambodia. It's about the second discussion we've had in the last 6 weeks. Before I introduce our speaker, I should say thanks to Hong Lim, who's the Labor member in the Victorian Parliament for Clorinda, based around the suburb of Clayton. Anne and I have been friends of Hong for a long time, and he made it possible for our speaker to be here tonight. So he couldn't be here because the Parliament's sitting in Victoria. So welcome to Monavitya Kem, who's a member of the Permanent Committee of Cambodia's principal opposition party, the Cambodian National Rescue Party, and she's going to speak to us tonight on the topic of Cambodia after the election. Ms. Kem, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank the Sydney Institute for putting this together at a very important time, I think. I'm here today to talk to all of you, especially those in Australia, because even the facade of Cambodia democracy has been falling down, and Cambodia is taking a dangerous turn to complete darkness. And how has that happened? I know a lot of you have been following what's going on, but I will give a very brief update on what has happened since September of last year. I don't think that would take 30 minutes, and then I will, if you have any question or suggestion, I would be happy to answer them. On September 2017, the leader of the opposition party, Mr. Kem Sok Kham, my father, also was arrested without a warrant. And he is now still in prison. It's been more than 11 months in solitary confinement in a maximum security prison at the border of Cambodia, Vietnam. He's been held illegally without a trial date set up for more than 11 months on the charge of treason. Also, on November of 2017, the only viable main opposition party in Cambodia, the Cambodia National Rescue Party, was banned, was dissolved, along with 118 of our officials have been banned from politics for 5 years. More than a dozen of independent radio stations and also newspaper, including both Khmer language and English language newspaper, have been dissolved, and a few that still left are operating under threats. Civil society that are working on human rights, specifically on election-related issue, have been working under threats as well, have been under a lot of threats and intimidation. And since September until now, there is absolutely no space for freedom of assembly, freedom of political participation, or freedom of speech. People cannot even gather more than several to discuss politics without local authority coming to question them, and sometimes even arrest them or take them into questioning at the police station. People cannot even comment on social media, such as Facebook, something that has that played a major role in the change that we saw in Cambodia in 2013 and so on. So I think what has happened since September until now is something unprecedented. I believe it has been the worst since the Civil War. In 1997, there was a coup, so there was physical violence. However, there was still some sort of political space left. There's still some sort of democratic elements left, free press, some sort of opposition. But now, there hasn't been no physical violence. However, there's absolutely no democratic space left, and every element of democracy has been dismantled, every single one of them. So this is not just about the opposition, the CNRP, or the leader, or even election. It's bigger than that. It's bigger than the election. It's bigger than the main opposition party. It's about Hun Sen regime. It's turning Cambodia into an effectively one-party state. So this goes against the spirit of the Paris Peace Agreement that was signed in 1991, which is why I just said that what just happened has been the worst since the Civil War. Because after the Civil War, we had the Paris Peace Accord, which stipulates that Cambodia would be a multi-party democracy. And since 1991 up until, I would say, July 29 of this year, there was some sort of facade of multi-party democracy. And sometimes that tried becoming a little bit looking like a real multi-party democracy, especially I think in 2013, 2014. But now even that facade, the Hun Sen regime is not even interested in putting up that facade anymore. If you look at the July 29 election, it can barely be qualified as an election for many reasons. Number one, the only viable opposition party was not on the ballot. Number two, the National Election Committee was unconstitutional. The original National Election Committee that was formed had the composition of both the representation from the ruling party, from our party, the opposition party, and also from civil society. But the election body that oversaw the July 29 election was a new election body that was completely unconstitutional. All the representatives from the opposition parties have been resigned, have been removed, and one of the member who came from civil society is still there but operating under threats. So just looking at that alone and the fact that there's absolutely no freedom of press, there's no competition, there's no real competition during the race, there's no legitimate election body, the July 29 election is not credible, is illegitimate. Therefore, the results of the July 29 election is also not credible. Therefore, whatever government that's going to be formed from that election, and I think they're planning to do that later this month, is also illegitimate. And that is why my colleague and I, my party and I, are traveling abroad to shed light on that and to call on the international community, especially Friends of Cambodia, to denounce such election. Meaning to denounce the government that's going to be formed shortly, sometime later this month. It is not a government representing the will of the Cambodian people. It's not a government that's formed from a real election. It was a complete circus. There was no credible international observers. Yeah, there were some from China and Russia. From countries that don't even hold a credible election themselves. And Australia, I believe, has an important role to play. I will first touch a little bit on what the world can do, what we all can do, what the international community can do, what the Cambodian people can do, and in particular, what the Australian government and Australia can do in helping to restore Cambodia's multi-party democracy. I think the international community has a special obligation to Cambodia because of the Paris Peace Accord. For example, in 1993, we are, I believe, the only country that had an election that was organized by the UN. Correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think there was any other country that had their election organized by a UN. So in that sense, Cambodia has a special relationship with the international community, the fact that it has a Paris Peace Accord. And I think although it's not mandated how long that that agreement, the Paris Peace Accord agreement, is supposed to be valid for, I believe the signatories of the Paris Peace Accord has an obligation to make sure that the parties that sign on the agreement fulfill the condition placed in the agreement in order for the signatory country to provide, for example, assistance to Cambodia. So since the Paris Peace Accord, Cambodia has been receiving a lot of assistance to rebuild our nation from many friendly countries. Australia, of course, is one of the biggest donor to Cambodia. And obviously Australia, as you know, played a really, really big role in putting together the peace accord that ended our civil war. So in that regard, the international community still has a role to play now that the Paris Peace Accord, the element, the spirit of the Paris Peace Accord has been violated by the Hun Sen regime, which is a party that signed on the accord. I believe the kind of help that the international community can provide to Cambodia's democracy, number one is to convene the key signatory of the Paris Peace Accord again, in whichever form, whether it's some sort of a conference. I'm not referring to something exactly like the Paris Peace Accord itself, like the conference that took place in 1991. But there has to be a multilateral initiative among the key signatory of the Paris Peace Accord, the country that signed on to the Paris Peace Accord, to finally meet and discuss, review the accord again, and make some recommendation now that Hun Sen regime has completely disregarded the accord. And I think Australia, obviously being a key player in putting together accord, has that role to play now. Australia, France, Indonesia, and we are appealing to these countries to start talking together. And of course, you may include any other country as well, any other pro-democracy country that's interested in helping Cambodia to rebuild ourselves. And I think that's the first step. That's the first step, is to have a multilateral talk of some form, some sort of conference. And we hope Australia can initiate that, since Australia did initiate our peace accord in 1991. In terms of concretely what exactly these countries can do, we obviously have some recommendations that we think would be effective in making the Hun Sen regime reconsider its actions. Number one, sanctions. I don't believe that the Hun Sen regime would even blink if he doesn't see sanction right in front of him. Even talk of sanction alone is not enough. There has to be step, concrete step, real step. Sanction has to be right in front of him. He has to feel the pain for him to consider reversing course. And I believe each country has different leverage, and I think different tools that they can use. Targeted individual sanction is one type that I think many countries can do. The U.S., for example, the United States has already done that and is going to expand more of that, particularly placing visa ban on Cambodian officials that have been found to be violating human rights and democracy in Cambodia. And we are urging the Australian government to do the same. Place a visa ban and asset freeze on Cambodian officials that have been violating human rights and democracy and found guilty of corruption in Cambodia. I believe that if Australia were to do that, it would be the most effective. Why? Sadly, your country is like the mafia hub of the ruling elites from Cambodia. That's a fact. I'm not sure if you have seen the Four Corner report, the Al Jazeera piece about the head of our tax guy money laundering. There's a lot of illegal activities going on here in Australia by the Cambodian elites who are coming in and out. Some of them are not citizens of Australia, some are. But placing a visa ban and investigating to the possibility of putting asset freeze on this individual, it's not just about sending a political message. I think it's your duty to protect even your own country, that these activities are not going on in your own country. And I think it would be the most effective thing that one of the most effective thing that the international community can do. Like I said, because Australia is the number one destination. This is the number one destination for the Cambodian ruling elites to send their children here for school, to smuggle drugs, buying visas. And they are even here threatening the lives and security of Cambodian Australian, of your own citizen. That just happened recently, and more than once, by low-level people, but also by the Prime Minister himself, by Hun Sen. So it's very, I think it's an obligation that Australian government needs to do something about that, needs to address that. Cambodia's democracy aside, you should still need to address that, because this is something that's happening in your country. And I believe this type of individual targeted sanction would have a lot of impact. Why? Because these elites are the reason why Hun Sen stays in power. He operates on the patronage sort of system. So if these people are facing difficulty, for example, if they're facing visa ban, they're facing asset freeze because of his action, because of his government action, they would pressure him to do otherwise. I really believe so. Because they would be looking out for their own well-being other than his. And that does not hurt the Cambodian people at large. And one other thing that I believe the Australian government can do, or a role that Australia can play, is again on the multilateral initiative, for example, at the UN level. It's very sad to not see Australia, being so close to Cambodia, being a key player in the Paris Peace Accord, not taking a leading role at the UN level. For example, at the last two Human Rights Council sessions, New Zealand was taking the lead. Yes, Australia also signed on the joint statement, but it's sad to see Australia not leading that effort with New Zealand. That is one of the multilateral initiatives that Australia can lead at the Human Rights Council. We have the session coming up again in September, and we hope there could be a strong resolution. And that could only happen if countries like Australia start to lead. And it's very important. Why Australia? Why are we picking on Australia? Because you're here in this region, close to us, close to Cambodia. This would be the closest country, the closest big the democratic country that closest to Cambodia. That, of course, here in Japan. There are Western countries, for example, there are a lot of European countries, there's the U.S. that have been speaking a lot on this issue on the multilateral level, but we need the voice from the region, and we have not really seen that yet, aside from New Zealand. So we hope that Australia, along with your closest friend, New Zealand, and hopefully with another friend like Japan, basically friends from this region, from Asia, would lead an initiative at the UN level. Another possibility is the UN General Assembly. I have been calling for Cambodia to be placed on the agenda since last December. And once again, Cambodia can only be on the agenda if countries like Australia, like Japan, advocate for that. And the General Assembly is happening this September, but even if we miss that, there's still other opportunity, but at least start thinking about it, start preparing for that. I think it's very little to ask for, just to have Cambodia on the agenda for discussion at the General Assembly. And I think it warrants for that, the situation now. This is the worst that has happened since the Civil War. It warrants a discussion at the UN level. And we cannot do it if member states, if important member states that have special relationship, special link to Cambodia, do not bring this up. And I think there are countries already that big democratic countries that are ready to help, ready to cooperate. There's the US, there's European countries. But again, once again, we need countries from this region. We need Australia, because Australia is a key country that helped put the Paris Peace Accord together. So you can play that role again. And this is almost as bad as before the Paris Peace Accord. We are going back to that era. We're going back to the 80s. I mean, Hun Sen is taking Cambodia back to the 80s. In some way, I believe now it's, if I may put that, if I may add that, I think now it's a little, even a little bit more dangerous. Now there is a regional implication. There's a regional implication. I think a lot of you might know what I am trying to refer to. And so it's not just about asking Australia to stand up for democratic values, for human rights value. It's also for your own security interest, for the long-term stability and long-term interest of the region, that Cambodia does not fall under the colonization or complete influence of one particular country. Whatever that country is, I don't care whether it's from the west or east or anywhere. And that's the direction that Cambodia is heading to right now. We are being under the influence of one particular country that happens to have to not share our values, the value of the Cambodian people. The Cambodian people want democracy and human rights. And quite frankly, that's not a Western value. That's just universal value. And we are very concerned. The people of Cambodia are very concerned in recent months to see a very powerful country stepping in, a country that does not share our values stepping in, in support of cracking down on the democratic and human rights value that the Cambodian people have been calling for since the 1991 peace accord. So for that reason, I believe the international community, especially countries in the region, pro-democracy country in the region, have an obligation to fulfill in terms of putting Cambodia back on track, back on a multi-party democracy system. And I believe that, I truly believe that a democratic Cambodia is in your interest. Not all, obviously it's in the interest of the Cambodian people, but it's also in your interest, so that you don't have thugs coming into, you don't have the mafia, the Cambodian mafia in Melbourne, you don't have people buying visa, you don't have people doing fake marriages or money laundering and setting up shady businesses here in your country. So to conclude, so what would happen if we don't do anything, we meaning observers, friends of Cambodia and the Cambodian people ourselves, what happen if nothing happens? What happen if nothing happens, if things continue to be the way it is now? I believe we would see something very similar to the 1980s in Cambodia. Except it's a lot worse, because now that Cambodians have been exposed to the world through social media in the last several years, and now that Cambodians travel more, we have, for example, we have migrant workers in South Korea, we have migrant workers in Thailand, seeing how a democratic, in particular, I'm referring to South Korea, a democratic country can operate and how they can benefit from such a system. I think the governing attitude would be similar to the 1980s, except the people will resist that. You don't see that now because I think people are in shock. People are in shock because of the arrest, of the cruel arrest of their leader, of the opposition leader, Kham Sokhan. People saw that on TV. I think people are in shock. But I believe once, if things continue to be like this going forward, the next few years, the next several years, people will begin to feel the pain. Cambodia will be, I believe, could possibly, very likely, face economic sanction. And that would hurt the Cambodian people. And the Cambodian people know who to blame. It's the people in power who refuse to fulfill the condition, for example, that's placed by the EU, the everything but arms trade privilege that we have been receiving, and which our economic growth in the last 10, 15 years has happened because of that, because of these privileges that we're getting from the West, from Australia as well. And once that's been, once that cuts or once that revoked, I think the country would go into chaos. And that's not good for anyone. It's obviously it's not good for the ruling elites either. In the short term, they might think it's good for them in the short term, I think because people are in shock and they have not yet feel the effects of what Hun Sen is doing. But I think they will in the next few years, in the next several years, if things don't change. Because I'm sure you know very well, Cambodia cannot survive on aid alone. Even if, let's say, there's one or two particular countries can provide aid to Cambodia, a country cannot grow based on aid. We had significant growth in the last 10, 15 years because of trade. Aid alone will not grow Cambodia. And we see a lot of investment coming to Cambodia now. Why? Because of the trade privilege that we received. And that in turn invites a lot of investment coming from all over the world. Obviously, not only the West, but also from some other parts on the East. But we won't see that anymore after if we lose the trade privileges that we have been receiving in the last 10, 15 years. So in that sense, I believe there would be economic crisis that would turn into social crisis, and that would be terrible for everyone. And now that the July 29 election took place, people no longer have faith in change through democratic means. We, the Cambodian National Rescue Party, we have been calling for change only through election. We have been explaining, especially Kem Sokha himself, for many years, that the only change that can happen that's long-lasting is the one through free, fair election. He even explained the negative consequences if change were to happen through violent means, and that we need to avoid that. But after July 29, if you're an average Cambodian, do you still believe that change can happen through election? Of course not. It doesn't take a genius to see that. So then if people want change, they would have to choose a different channel. And yes, now people are quiet because they are in fear, they are in shock because of the limited space that they have. But out of survival reason, in the next few years, the next several years, people will have to act. Because it's about survival instinct. And I think then they would push for change through a different channel. And that's something that we all want to avoid. And that's something we want to avoid. That's why we are having this discussion today, for example. Because we want to avoid that. We want to put Cambodia back on track. So in short, I believe that there is still time. And I don't think that dictatorship, whether it's Hun Sen regime or any other dictatorship, is going to last forever. I think it's coming to an end as well. I think we're at the last stretch of the fight, which is why it's so difficult. Which is why they're cracking down on us so hard. Because we're this close, we're 1 inch away from positive change, big positive change. So I'm still optimistic. And I believe that some of the things that I mentioned would be applied, I believe that this regime would reconsider its course. It won't be perfect, but would be something that we can work, we can get Cambodia back on track. Thank you for your interest, and I'm looking forward to hear your comments or answer any question you have.
So many thanks to our speaker, and thanks for all of you coming along tonight. We put this together in less than a week, so it's good to see you all here. So now we come to questions and discussion. We have plenty of time. We're going no later than the top of the hour. So if I get Ms. Kim to come back here, and we'll be away. Thanks for an important address on a very significant topic. Just tell us a bit about Hun Sen, because in Australia, those who remember, just come a bit forward, the time, know that he was originally a member of the Khmer Rouge. He split with Pol Pot's faction. He was said to be a more moderate member of the Khmer Rouge, but he had been a Khmer Rouge commander. Now, 4 decades on, I mean, is this a communist regime, or is it just a corrupt regime that wants to maintain power? And would that explain why these developments you've referred to have really taken place in the last year, including the imprisonment of your father? I mean, what's the hurry, and what's Hun Sen? What do you think he's about?
I think the tactics that the Hun Sen regime has employed since the 90s until now it's communist tactic. It's the same tactic as Pol Pot, but he's more creative. He fashioned them better. For example, when I said there's absolutely no freedom of assembly, when several people gather together and discuss, then they're being spied on, they're being asked questions by authority. That's what happened during Pol Pot time. You can't talk. You can't talk to each other. So he's employing the same thing. And then they assign, for example, in each village, one person to watch 10 people. That's what happened during Pol Pot time. It's the same tactic. So in that sense, I believe that Cambodia, in effect, under Hun Sen's ruling, is a dictatorship. It's communist may not be the exact term that I would use. It's authoritarian. And it's very similar to the way Pol Pot was functioning. It's the same guy with the same mentality, and that's all he knows. So I think that's what he's about.
Thank you. So, we go here, and you what? Well, it's down here. Yeah.
Amongst the international entities that you think might have an influence on Cambodia's behaviour, or the Cambodian government's behaviour, you don't mention ASEAN. And yet, the Australian Foreign Minister believes that Australia should take its lead from ASEAN in its dealings with Cambodia. What do you think of that?
We have obviously been trying to talk to ASEAN countries as well. Some are more receptive than others. And thankfully, because there's a new government in Malaysia, for example, the new Malaysian government, the foreign minister, my colleague has met with him, and they are quite receptive. So we have something to start with in ASEAN. But in the past, before the new Malaysian government was formed, no one was even talking to us. And to have an expectation that they would take on the cost of the defense of democracy and human rights, I think it's unrealistic, because some of the countries in ASEAN themselves are not respecting those values in their own home. So why would they defend that values in our country? But nonetheless, there is a little bit of hope because of the new Malaysian government that's a friend of democracy, I would say, and they have been receptive. So we are trying to push that. But at the same time, I think Australia has its own interests. Being a leader, you take the lead. You don't take the cue from ASEAN, but you're actually taking the lead, especially if Australia wants to play a big role in ASEAN, in the region. I'm not talking about the organization, but in the region.
Considering that you are as outspoken as you are, what are the issues around your own safety and security in Cambodia?
When my father, Gamsukha, was arrested, I was already abroad. And I have not been home since, because the government has made clear publicly that I would be arrested at the airport. And that came from the Ministry of Interior. So I think that's the status of my security. But in terms of being abroad, of course, I feel very safe being in the US, being in Europe. But quite frankly, when I was in Melbourne, I was scared. My mother was scared. She said, be careful when you go to the Springvale, the Cambodian area, because we hear that all these Cambodian mafia coming from the ruling party are there. Quite frankly, I was scared in Melbourne, and that's something that I think Australia should think about.
With respect to speaking about Hun Sen being a dictator, what's your view on the current Australian government's relationship with business deals and so forth with Hun Sen, for example, the refugee deal between Australia and Cambodia?
I would let the Australian themselves, Australian people, judge the refugee deal, because it's not my business in that sense whether or not it's good for Australia. I don't think it is. But I also think that the Australian people don't think that it is a good deal. It doesn't impact Cambodia because there's only 4 people that have been in Cambodia. So I just think it's a bad deal for your country, and there's no reason for your country to be engaged in such a deal. But once again, that's the discretion of the Australian people to voice on. In terms of the relationship, aside from the refugee deal between the Australian government and Cambodian government, they have always had close relationship. And I think the Australian government overlooked many human rights democracy issue, not just recently because of the crackdown, even in the past. That's how they formed these like mafia like in Melbourne here. Because Australia has been too loose on that, I think, the Australian government. And the Australian government has not really had any, I would say, a clear policy on Cambodia for years. Not just letting alone about this crackdown. That's my personal view.
Ms. Kim, I was a reporter at the Hugh Clayburgh conference in 1991 when our then Foreign Minister Gareth Evans and Alatas of Indonesia organised the conference. I was castigated at the time by our Foreign Minister for daring to suggest that in the committee stages the word genocide had been omitted from all of the documentation in order to get the Khmer Rouge to cooperate at the conference. Have you spoken with Mr. Evans recently about whether he has a role to play in reconvening or helping and assisting a reconvening of such a conference, given that his good offices led in the first place to the peace agreement?
Thank you. I actually just met him in Melbourne 2 days ago, and I met him before in 2014, again, in similar situation during crisis like this. I don't believe, correct me if I'm wrong, he doesn't have an official role, but I believe that he is interested in helping, influencing Australia to take an active role or a leading role in what I suggested earlier in making sure that Cambodia respect the spirit of the Paris Peace Accord. He has genuine interest, and he expressed that interest. He has spoken publicly as well. I believe in March with my colleague in Canberra, and also I think he has an op-ed out recently. So he has interest, but I don't know, and I think you would know better than I do, how much influence he has over the Australian government. But I believe he has interest, and I think he would be happy to play a role if your government would allow him to play such a role.
Just on the economic side, you argued against sanctions because they would hurt. Apart from specific sanctions aimed at the ruling regime, you argued against it because they would hurt Cambodian citizens. I suppose as Australia interacts with Cambodia, there's business dealings and there's quite a bit of tourism, I think. What do you think Australians should be doing? Should they be visiting Cambodia in the current climate, or should they not be visiting?
First of all, I did not argue against economic sanction, and I believe it would happen if Hun Sen does not reverse course, because it's an agreement between Hun Sen government and, for example, the EU. And in an agreement, there's a list of conditions that they have to fulfill. So when you don't fulfill that, they will investigate, which they just did, and then they will make a recommendation whether or not to revoke. So for the record, I do not argue that there should not be economic sanction. And I think Hun Sen is inviting economic sanction, and that's unfortunate. But what I want is to help the country, our country, Cambodia, to evade that by fulfilling the recommendation and the condition that's called for by the EU and the US, for example, so that we can continue to keep the trade privilege that we receive. Regarding tourism and what Australia can do, whether or not Australians should visit Cambodia, I think Australians should still visit Cambodia. Cambodia is a beautiful place and very, very, very friendly people. I'm sure a lot of you would agree with me on that. And I think once you go, you always return. You don't just go once. What Australia can do instead, as I raised earlier, is using specific targeted sanction on individuals and not being unfriendly toward the country, because it's not the country that's doing this. It's a group of very small group of people. So I would say the focus should be on them and not on our country or on our people.
Could you tell us a little bit about the party your father, whether he founded it, represents? Where are the members of that party from? Because in Australia, I don't think we understand fully a lot of what's happened to Cambodia post-Khmer Rouge. So much of it was destroyed, including the population. where is the new, you know, the new Cambodia coming from? Where does the where, how did this party start? Where was your father to start this party? Can you tell us a bit more about it?
Thank you. The CNRP, although it's a new party that's formed in 2012, but it is formed by old people. Old people, meaning that people that's been in politics since the Paris Peace Accord from various party. For example, Mr. Samrinsi, he's always been there since the Paris Peace Accord. My father, Kem Sokhai, has always been involved in politics in the Paris Peace Accord, and they're with the pro-democracy groups. And a lot of other colleagues, senior members, they have always been in politics since the since 1993, a lot of them. And of course, there are newer people. Cambodia is a very young country. So in terms of supporter and some of the new leadership now, they are newer people that are new to politics. And I think the formation of the CNRP in 2012, which is the merger between the two democratic opposition in Cambodia, inspired new people to join in. I hope that answered your question a little bit. So there's quite a bit of new blood in the CNRP in the sense that they were not interested in opposition politics before because they thought it was hopeless. But since we formed this sort of coalition, the CNRP, there are a lot of new people joining our cause. A lot of them in the form of just being supporter and voters, but a lot also in leadership level, up to pretty senior level as well.
Well, just following up, tell us a bit about your father. I know he's in prison, but just a bit about his background.
He's a biochemist. He's an applied scientist. He studied law in Cambodia before Phnom Penh fell. And he has always been involved since the 1980s in terms of fighting for democracy in Cambodia. Before the Paris Peace Accord, he was secretly supporting the freedom fighters at the border. And he got in trouble by that. He was almost thrown in prison by the state of Cambodia then. So he's someone who lived through Pol Pot, someone who was secretly supporting the other side during the Vietnamese occupation. During the state of Cambodia, he was supporting the freedom fighters. And then once they came back into the country after the Paris Peace Accord, then immediately he joined the Sun San Party, the Buddhist Liberal Democratic Party, then one of the two main opposition party in 1993. So he's always been involved, and he's been a human rights activist for as long as I know. And I've joined his journey since 9, 10 years old. Before he became a member of parliament, he founded the first human rights NGO in Cambodia. It was called the Cambodia Vigilant of Human Rights. Something about vigilant and human rights. But it was one of, I think, either that or Lee Kado was one of the first human rights NGO in Cambodia. So he's always been, his background, it's more human rights. Human rights plus politics.
First of all, it's an honour to hear you speak, and thank you so much for coming to Sydney. I'm really interested in what united the people in terms of the CNRP's policies. What were the key issues or problems of the Hun Sen government that the people were tired of and which you use as your platform to unite them?
Thank you. That's a very good question, and it doesn't get asked anymore. it's social injustice or social justice. The lack of social justice is what have been driving people to support the alternative to change the status quo. Social injustice in many forms. Sometimes, for example, specifically you can look at the court system. The judiciary system is extremely corrupt, and it's just a remote control of the elite. So for any matter, it's not just on political cases, it's on anything. You can never find justice. Even as simple about traffic accident or traffic ticket, even small things like that, or vendors selling things at the market, they're being abused by the justice system. So I believe it's that. It's that has been driving people to want change. And then second, I would say it's about people wanting better schools, better job, better healthcare. But I even placed that second. I think number one is social injustice, because that is so widespread in Cambodia. And then number two, it's, you know, wanting to better yourself, to build yourself. And when you're lacking that opportunity, you're a young person, you want a better school. And when you can't access that, you want better. When you're a young mother or you're a new couple, you want better health care. And we have, it's very, if you know about the health statistics in Cambodia, it would scare you. So I think those sort of everyday life issue are the second thing that drive people to support the CNRP.
Question down there. We're getting towards the end, so yeah.
Hi. Check that out. Yeah. Hi. Oh, yeah, so I'll say the word China. So we've recently seen, major Chinese investment in Sinopil, and the Chinese Foreign Ministry recently congratulate Cambodia on their smooth elections. So you've mentioned typical, I'd say, instruments of the West, let's say multilateralism and sanctions. So I feel like an effect of that would push Hun Sen closer and more dependent on China. So just wondering, how do you see a way forward in that, in the prism of China, in terms of like the growing relations?
Thank you. Newsflash, you already lost Cambodia to China. To the West, that is, to democracy country. Cambodia cannot get any closer to China. It would become one if it does. So actually, it's for that reason. That's why the West has every reason to put Cambodia back on track. Of course, for the reason for the respect of the democratic and human rights value, but also for security, for interest in the region. And when you're talking about sanction pushing, there are a lot of Chinese investment coming to Cambodia. You know, a lot of the investment, like I said, coming to Cambodia also because of the economic growth, right? Economic growth invites foreign investment, and that growth actually came from the generosity of the West. And particularly in Japan as well, all these aid and the trade privileges that we receive from the EU and that we receive from the US, and the number one driver of economic growth for many, many years with the government sector. And again, that's tied directly to the everything but arms trade privilege that the EU granted us. So quite frankly, if that were to happen, that were to be canceled, Chinese companies will be hurt. It's not just Cambodian, and actually those factories are owned by the Chinese. So I hope that answers your questions.
We'll just come there in a minute. Just the other country we haven't spoken about specifically is Vietnam. And as you know, Vietnam has its own problems with China. So has there been any improvement in the Vietnam-Cambodia relationship as you see it?
When you say Cambodia, it's opposition Cambodia and then government Cambodia. I think Cambodian government has been able to provide both China and Vietnam what they want. It's a very difficult thing to do, but they managed to do it. I think each gets what they want from Cambodia, and Hun Sen has kept them both happy. Even though you see that we are sort of the Cambodian government, not we, the Cambodian government is moving towards one direction, but at the same time, that has not yet upset Vietnam, because there's other interests in Cambodia that Vietnam is still receiving from the Hun Sen government.
Thank you for your warning about the influence is not just the dictatorship, it's not just over there, but over here. And my question is, as you're visiting the community here in New South Wales on the weekend, are you aware of the foreign interference in New South Wales, particularly in relation behind the scenes in terms of two Supreme Court cases in New South Wales and community disputes? And second question, do you have any comments to say about the role of the Cambodian ambassador in foreign interference in Australia?
Thank you. I'm not familiar with the Supreme Court cases that you mentioned, but I will talk a little bit about the Cambodian ambassador and then the role that he plays here. The Cambodian ambassador here, he acts as a party agent for the ruling party. And he oppresses the Cambodians that are living here. I'm not talking about Australian in particular, Cambodian Australian, but for example, the students that are coming here, Cambodian students that are coming here on scholarship, on Australian scholarship, on your money, on the taxpayers' money. They're being coerced, they're being threatened to serve the political agenda of the Hun Sen government. Otherwise, they would be threatened to be pulled back, or they would not get a scholarship. For them to even be granted a scholarship to begin with, they had to agree to be supporting activities and the political agenda of Hun Sen in Australia. So the Cambodian ambassador is definitely not acting as a civil servant. He's definitely a party agent, and I think it's quite visible as well with his ruling party uniform. That looks a lot like Khmer Rouge uniform, by the way, except with the baby blue shirt. But so with that regard, yes, Cambodians that are living here, that are coming here, Cambodians, average Cambodians that are not citizens of Australia, are under pressure and coercion of the Cambodian embassy here.
There's a question here.
Is the legal profession organised in Cambodia? And if so, does it make its voice criticisms heard?
The legal profession?
Yes, is it active in speaking out for human rights and legal propriety? The Cambodian lawyers, are they active?
They are not active. For example, the Cambodian Bar Association is completely controlled by the ruling party. But there are, of course, individual lawyers, individual legal experts that work for human rights NGO. So those people have been advocating for democracy and human rights and defending some of that value. Some of them were imprisoned last year. And a lot of them now are being under threats. But these are individual legal experts who work for human rights NGOs, not specifically in the legal field or legal profession, as you said.
Thank you. So second last question here.
Thank you for your rousing speech. I just wanted to know, given, and you touched on it in your speech, Australia's role in the peace agreement and the formation of the current democratic system, given Australia's role in that and its subsequent failure to become kind of like a pluralist and, you know, relatively thriving democratic system, does Australia have a bit of an extra moral role in the coming years to kind of assist in the rectifying of this situation?
Yes, of course. I think Australia has a moral responsibility, indeed. That was your question, yes? If I understood correctly. Yeah, Australia has a moral responsibility, and just the fact that we have a lot of Cambodian diaspora here as well. I think even that, if you're talking about sentiment and being very close to Australia is the biggest democratic country that's closest to us. I mean, if we can't count on you, that's very sad. Because we're supposed to be looking up to you for democratic value, for the defense of democracy. And in that sense, yes, I think Australia does have a moral obligation to help the Cambodian people, help ourselves to put the multi-party democracy system back in Cambodia.
So just finally, tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, where did you start off, and tell us why you came here. You're very welcome here, but did you come here to speak to Australians about what we should do, or to Cambodian Australians about how they can help, or did you just come here to speak generally? And where do you go next? I mean, how long does this sort of campaign continue?
Actually, I have been traveling, doing similar things like this since September, since my father's arrest. But also I have a role with the party, obviously before the crisis, on international relations. So this is just a sort of a special mission because there's a crisis and the fact that our party is dissolved and my own father's in prison. I am here during this trip, I will meet with the Australian government. I will. I'm very happy to hear that the foreign minister has accepted the meeting. So I will meet her in Canberra on August 15. And I have met with some of the federal members as well on the opposition side. And I have been meeting with the Cambodian diaspora, discussing with them what they can do, as you mentioned, what they can do as citizens of Australia. And they have done tremendous things. For example, they have been doing a lot of protests that drawing the attention of the press, the Australian press, and also the government. I think the reason that the government is paying attention now, a little bit more of attention now, is because the diaspora has been active. And of course, they have been talking to their representative. And it's them that set up meeting for me. It's Hong Lim, it's the community that have been setting up meetings for me with the Australian government. So yes, they have a big role to play. After this, I am planning to go to Europe and New Zealand first, a quick stop in New Zealand first, because there's the UN Human Rights Council session coming up, the initiative that I mentioned. Yes, they have been leading, taking the lead, but it's good to sort of follow up and to continue to push, and hopefully Australia would be talking to New Zealand to work on that together. And before here, I was in the U.S., and I've been all over the world, really. I was in Japan as well, doing similar thing, mostly talking to the government itself of these countries. And there has been some positive results, and Australia is the only one that's really lacking, to be honest. Anywhere else, in terms of democratic countries, they're sort of moving forward already, whether it's slow or whether it's not enough, that's one question, but it's in the motion. Things are happening. Here's like nothing has happened. So hopefully after the meeting in Canberra, something would start, something would happen.
Well, many thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Ms. Kim. I mean, as you know, a foreign minister in a country like Australia is a very busy person. I think it's terrific that Julie Bishop is going to meet you, and I hope it goes as well as possible. And as you know, you mentioned Hong Lim. You've got a lot of support in the Labor Party as well as within other areas of Australian politics, so good luck with that. Look, I'll be very brief tonight. It's an important issue. You've given us a very good insight into Cambodia. We've been following Cambodia at the Institute here for 30 years, and we had a lot of discussions early on about the original Australian involvement in the peace process, and now you've come along and given us honest news, but not good news, about where the country's been for the last year particularly. It's an important presentation tonight. We're delighted to have it. We'll publish it, and we'll publish it in due course in the Sydney papers online. But I should also just say to you that congratulate you on your courage. It's not an easy job to be advocating the causes you're advocating. I think it's very... I have heard this from my own friends in the Cambodian Australian community, that there are threats to people's lives in that community, and that is deeply disturbing, and all Australians should be aware of that, and I'm very pleased you spoke about it here. So, for tonight, congratulations and good luck.
Thank you.
And also, good luck to your father.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.